Dr. Cheryl Silman, and welcome to What Women Must Know. Thank you for joining me today for another wonderful in-depth conversation that will certainly inspire you and help you to live the healthiest life possible, because that really is the goal of this program. And every week the show is dedicated to empowering you with truthful information so you can have the greatest opportunity to live the life you were meant to live, healthy, vital, with all your faculties intact, and allowing you to really get on with the purpose that you were meant to have in this lifetime. So another great show is in store. Before I get there, I always like to welcome new listeners and invite you to go to my website, which is whatwomenmustknow.com, and my Facebook page is also What Women Must Know, and both those places are opportunities for you to like or to opt in, and you will get all of my weekly radio shows sent to you, so you won't miss any of them, and you don't want to miss any of them, because they're all filled with such inspiring information. And also, I always share further information, articles, studies, and you get free reports on my website. So hope you will be joining me there and just continuing this process of getting enlightened with what I like to call truthful information, practical solutions to really help you on your way in your life. And when we talk about really getting on your way in a healthy way in your life, I am really excited about the topic that we will be talking about and having a wonderful conversation about today. And it's really exploring a breakthrough program to prevent and reverse cognitive decline, and I have to say, at any age. So this is such an important topic. It's really a health concern that is affecting millions of people, not just people who are dealing with cognitive decline and at risk of Alzheimer's, but families and communities. It just has huge ramifications. So I have some very special guests today who have written a fantastic book called The Alzheimer's Solution, a breakthrough program to prevent and reverse the symptoms of cognitive decline at every age. And I want to introduce to you today my wonderful guests who've made the time to be here, Dr. Aisha Shirzai and Dr. Dean Shirzai. So let me just tell you a little bit about them. Aisha is co-director of the Alzheimer's Prevention Program at Loma Linda University Health, where she leads the lifestyle program for the prevention of neurological diseases. She completed a dual training in preventative medicine and neurology at Loma Linda University, received a master's degree in advanced research methodology from the University of San Diego, and completed a fellowship in lifestyle and vascular brain diseases at Columbia University. She will soon complete a PhD in epidemiology from Loma Linda University, where her dissertation focuses on nutrition and its role in cognitive aging and neurological diseases. She is the lead researcher in the landmark study at Loma Linda that investigates the effects of a comprehensive lifestyle intervention on individuals at risk for Alzheimer's. And Dr. Dean Shirzai is co-director of the Alzheimer's Prevention Program at Loma Linda University Health, where he was previously the director of the Memory and Aging Center, as well as director of research during his years at Loma Linda, a blue zone community where residents live measurably longer and healthier lives. He was the lead scientist studying the effects of healthy living on cognitive aging. Dean trained in neurology at Georgetown University School of Medicine and completed fellowships in neurodegenerative diseases and dementia at the National Institutes of Health and University of San Diego. He also holds a PhD in healthcare leadership with a focus on community health and a master's in public health from Loma Linda, where his research focused on the prevention of cognitive decline through lifestyle changes. And they are both the co-authors of their latest book, their new book, The Alzheimer's Solution. So, wow, having having gone through all that and being so impressed with the dedication and the amount of education and research you both have done, I'd like to welcome Dean and Aisha Shirzai to the show. So welcome, both of you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Cheryl. Thank you. So nice to be here with you again.
And by the way,
Mean
ping pong game too.
You know, I always have to admit I'm so impressed with people like yourselves, you know, dedicated people who've spent so many years studying, researching, just being so committed to staying on the leading edge. I know it's just such a consuming passion that you both have at this point in time.
Absolutely, yes. For us, it's a personal journey. As we had mentioned in the book, you know, we had grandparents who had dementia and Alzheimer's, and we saw how they slowly and gradually lost parts of themselves, and it was a very painful process for us, for our parents. And so we promised ourselves that we would study more about it and find out what we can do about it.
Well, you've done a great job because you put so much information together. So before we jump into what your research has revealed, I want to just talk a little bit about Loma Linda because it's such an interesting, I think it's a really interesting place. I've never been there, but I know that whenever they talk about these blue zone areas of the world where people live exceptionally long, healthy lives, Loma Linda is always considered one of those blue zone communities. And you're involved with Loma Linda. What's going on there?
Yeah, so Loma Linda is the only blue zone in America. And by all measures, it's the only one that's been really, truly measured. And there's tremendous amount of validation and clinical trials, as well as a 50-year study that's been supported by NIH on this population. It's not specifically Loma Linda. As it happens, it's the Seventh-day Adventist population, but the largest group is here in Loma Linda. The university and the hospital is here. So we wanted to come here from NIH and Georgetown and all these other places to study lifestyle as it pertains to brain health. We've known about lifestyle and everything else, from cancer to heart disease to diabetes, but it was time to study it in the most important organ of them all, which is the brain. Loma Linda is a remarkable place because it's been shown over and over again in study after study that people live actually, or the Seventh-day Adventists, that live a certain type of life. Remember that the Seventh-day Adventists don't all live the same kind of life. So that this actually gives us an opportunity to study the whole diverse presentation of lifestyle. They live 10 years longer and healthier than others, everybody else. And there's no genetic difference. It's only one thing. It's environment and lifestyle.
So that's what we're going to be exploring, and that population, Loma Linda, provides the evidence that what they are doing is something that can be replicated in our lives if we understand what are these key components that really support our overall well-being, and we're going to be particularly talking about cognitive functioning. So it must be such an interesting place to be researching, is all I can say, and must be very inspiring for you to see these people living vital, healthy lives in the 80s, 90s, 100.
It was shocking for us to see that over and over again, we see people in their 90s, and they're more active than others in their 60s in other communities. You know, walking 3, 4, 5 miles a day, involved in community events, in church events, volunteering, even doing, you know, surgery. One of the famous doctors here, Dr. Wareham, who has now retired, was doing surgery up to age 95. Not the kind of surgery that you see other senior doctors do where they just come and stand and others perform the surgery. He did open to close surgery. This is remarkable population. There's, you know, you see all these fad diets and fad this and fad that coming out. It's time for people to look at where the data truly is and has been. And, you know, what we did is not really that controversial. We just brought the same data and shed light on it as it pertains to brain. There is no significant controversy. I mean, that might not be good for book sales, but that's not the point. The point is to kind of shed light on true science, true facts, not the fad of the day.
So, well, first of all, I think that's really inspiring that, you know, what we're observing with that population are all the factors that are really written about in your book that are part of the overall strategy to stay healthy in general and cognitive function specifically, what we're talking about today. So let's look at what is going on in the world of cognitive health and this growing incidence of Alzheimer's, but it's not just Alzheimer's. It's all the other cognitive, you know, challenges that people are facing, whether it's, you know, memory lapses of names, or whether it's, you know, the inability to recall other things or focus, or, you know, just the many variations on a theme that impairs our body's ability to have optimal cognitive functioning, which, you know, if not addressed, can potentially, I would imagine, lead to more serious and potentially chronic conditions like Alzheimer's. So what are your thoughts about all that? Aisha, do you want to talk a bit about that?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think we're in a stage where we're seeing, you know, all the problems that you just mentioned, and not necessarily just dementias on Alzheimer's. You tend to see other diseases of the brain, vascular cognitive impairment, minor strokes, symptoms of stroke, and, you know, being a vascular neurologist, I see a lot of that. And I think it's probably multifactorial. I think it's probably because we have had a good hold on some of the other diseases that were the main causes of mortality for decades, you know, things like high blood pressure and diabetes and high cholesterol and heart disease specifically. We're having better control over them. We have better diagnostic techniques to detect them early and do something about it. And there are medication that not necessarily improve quality of life, but essentially, you know, they delay mortality related to those diseases. But, you know, for some of the people who are living longer, but they're living sicker, you see the consequences to brain health. And for the brain, you know, it's a very susceptible organ. If there is an abnormality in a system in the body, the brain gets affected. But again, it's very resilient too, so you don't see the symptoms very, very quickly. So as time goes on, you slowly and gradually start seeing the manifestation of all these pathologies in the brain. You know, whether it's smaller strokes or high blood pressure causing damage to the arteries in the brain, or it's diabetes that is causing structural damage to the cells and the connective tissues in the brain, all of these end up resulting in, you know, things like memory lapses, being foggy, having very vague symptoms of not really knowing what's going on, also having some, you know, psychological and psychiatric manifestations such as depression and anxiety, all of them leading to damage to the brain. And then finally, it manifests into dementias and Alzheimer's disease and strokes. So, you know, we're seeing the whole spectrum of how these diseases start. And now, especially for Dean and I, we now know that the disease actually, diseases of the brain start very, very early, decades before they, you know, you actually see the signs and symptoms. That's why there's so much emphasis on prevention, understanding how the brain works, and starting very early. It's never too early to start thinking of our brain and our brain health.
And, you know, we don't normally think about brain health, especially when you're younger. You don't think about, you know, essentially how to preserve your brain, because most of the time we think our brain is working just fine. We're focusing on
right,
maybe, you know, our weight or choosing some healthy diet, or, you know, just overall well-being. But as the older you get, the more you really appreciate the role of your brain and how important it is to
yes,
take care of it. And it gets disconcerting, you know, when you start missing those words, you know, or those names, you know.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think, you know, for decades, I think the brain has been considered like a black box, just like you said, you know, something that cannot be affected, something that, you know, is completely independent of all the other processes that are going on in the brain. But that's just not true. You know, whatever happens to our body, whatever we expose our body to, first and foremost affects our brain, and then it affects the rest of the body. But the resilient organ that it is, you don't see the effects of environmental risk factors and all the stresses that we go through on a regular basis. But it does take a toll after a while.
I mean, this book is titled Alzheimer's Solution, but it's actually a book about how to maintain your brain health. What you see, by the time you see the changes, by the time you see some memory problems, significant memory problems, there's been significant damage to the brain. Let me give you an idea of another disease, Parkinson's. By the time you see the first symptoms of Parkinson's, the tremor, there's a part of the brain that's mostly affected in that disease, substantia nigra. By that time, anywhere between 60 to 80% of the cells in that region are lost. The same is true for a lot of the other neurological and brain diseases. By the time you see the effect, a lot of damage will have been done. So the whole purpose of this book is to say, start early. I mean, I will tell you, if it was up to me, as early as childhood, because now we have an epidemic of diabetes in children and obesity in children, and you know, with all this junk food and processed food that's accumulating toxins in our body. But more importantly, the way we address this is as if we can just not worry about the most vital organ in the body, the organ that is 3 pounds but consumes 25% of our energy. That means that it's actually producing 25% weight. It's actually using all the food, 25% of the food that we're taking, and good or bad, it's just putting it into the system. How could it not be affected from very early on? And then we give it titles and we just put it aside until we're in our 60s, 70s, and 80s, and by then a lot of damage will have been done. The point is to start early, know that the brain is resilient, yes, but it's also under a lot of attack that you can change the story and the narrative very early on or at any point, but the point is to start it now. That's the beauty of this.
Let me ask you a question. Do you think that the conditions and issues that compromise brain health are any different than the issues and the underlying causes that are contributing to the epidemic of chronic diseases across the board right now? Diabetes, cancer, all that. You know, what are your thoughts?
It's yes and no. In many ways, it is the same ones. If it's a high sugar levels, high saturated fat levels, which lead then to cholesterol buildup and lipid, the arteries closing, the sugar causing insulin resistance and shocking the cells, inflammation, all of these are the same. But in many ways, it's actually a little different. We say that if you take care of the brain, if our healthcare system was brain-centered, you will take care of all of the rest of the body and more, because you have one little other element to this, which is the emotional component. The brain has the emotional aspect. The other organs are non-emotive, non-emotional. They're very direct, the liver, the kidney, the heart. The brain has the motivational centers, the emotional centers, which are affected by what we do. Let me give you an example. Exercise has been found to be significantly more effective, repeatedly, than any medication for depression and anxiety. But nobody talks about it. Why? Because you can't write it in a prescription. The same thing with food, when it comes to ADHD, when it comes to attention, when it comes to focus, when it comes to even depression, anxiety, foods have been shown to relate to those things. So, and if you don't address those elements, forget about behavior change, forget about motivation, forget about compliance to medication. So in many ways, the brain's underlying pathology is moved by the same thing, and we've laid that out in a very systematic way as it relates to the brain, but also it's much bigger than that. So we say that if you take care of your brain, and this is the decade or the century of the brain, actually, and I said the century of the brain, if we start focusing on the brain, not, as Aisha said, as a black box, but as an amazing organ that you can not only affect to delay or stop diseases, but actually grow as you grow get older, then we have basically changed our whole healthcare, our own health altogether.
What I find really interesting in some of the research that I've been doing is the potential, the reality of the fact that we can build and create new brain cells throughout our entire life. Rather than thinking that we lose them and that's the end, we actually can be birthing new brain cells if we do the right strategies or the right foods. Until our last breath.
That's so empowering, isn't it, Cheryl? I find that so exciting. You can definitely create more connections and synaptic connections and strengthen the communication between cells on a regular basis. you know, we always give examples to our patients to simplify it. You know, brain cells can have as little as 2 to 3 connections or as many as 30,000 connections. And it's such a disservice to the brain to compare it to a muscle, because even the best bodybuilder can build their muscle, say, for example, 3 or 4 times its size. But the brain can grow exponentially. And everything we do around us, you know, good sleep, good food, exercise, management of stress, meditation, and, you know, keeping our minds challenged, all of these activities build connections. And these connections are like the money you put in a bank account on a rainy day. It will serve as resilience and protections at times when we need it, at times of stress, at times of disease, at times of, you know, whether it's mental stress or physical stress. All of it actually makes a big difference. And we've actually had objective evidence seeing this when people were exposed to, say, for example, you know, strenuous exercise or a challenge in cognitive activity. The brain literally grows. In one study, it showed that the hippocampi, the areas that are responsible for memory in the brain, they actually grew by a large percentage in individuals who were exposed to a strenuous activity compared to those who weren't. So this is such a great news, in my opinion.
That's great news for me, too, because it's never too late, really. It's never too late.
Absolutely.
And I think that's what you see at Loma Linda. When you see these centenarians, you know, doing amazing things, you know it's never too late. So before we jump into the solutions and some of the strategies, and we'll get into some of the factors that contribute to impaired cognitive functioning, I wanted you to share some of the facts that you have, some of the statistics about what actually is going on right now in our culture, in our society, in our country, in regards to cognitive decline.
Yes, so the numbers are very scary. We have more than 5 million individuals living in the United States with Alzheimer's disease, and more with dementia. So dementia is the bigger category, and Alzheimer's is the biggest type of dementia. About 60 to 80% of all dementias are Alzheimer's disease. And this number is growing. Every 67 seconds, somebody is diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, and if we don't do anything about it, if we don't start preventing it at this point, by 2050, this number could be as high as 16 million. And, you know, for women, almost two-thirds of people with Alzheimer's disease are women, and that's a scary number. For women in their 60s, each one of them have a very high lifetime risk of Alzheimer's disease. 1 in 6 women have a chance of developing Alzheimer's disease compared to 1 in 11 for men. And, you know, more than 60% of Alzheimer's caregivers are actually women as well. So, you know, disproportionately, this is a women's disease. And we're still in the process of finding out why that is, you know, what are the gender differences between men and women. And this is one of our interests, and Dean and I are actually doing a lot of research on it at Loma Linda University.
Well, any speculation, any conjecture why you think women are more vulnerable?
So there have been a few theories. Hormonal changes after menopause has been something of interest, and people have been looking at it. But so far, we don't have any, you know, concrete answer. Yeah, let me give you an example. You know, for other diseases, say, for example, lung cancer, we know that non-smoking women are more than twice as likely as men to get that disease. Now, they've done a lot of research at the molecular level to find out, you know, what is going on. And they found out that there are certain genetic mutations and hormonal changes that are different in these women who don't smoke and get lung cancer. And this has led to more research. But we don't have that level of specific and granular research in Alzheimer's disease as of yet to look into it. But the speculations are, you know, it's probably because women live longer and these hormonal changes after menopause put them at a higher risk of Alzheimer's disease. And then when you look at, you know, some of the social aspects, women are caregivers. They tend to suffer more from stress and the anxiety of taking care of their loved ones, and their lifetime risk factor as it pertains to lifestyle is completely different from men. So those are some of the things that we're actually studying right now.
And as an anecdote, my own personal research, it's not the men putting the stress.
No, right? You're absolved of all guilt. Not all.
Some. it's a sample of one, but I'm going to stand by it. I'm just kidding.
You know, when I look at this, it's, you know, I guess like many of the chronic illnesses that are just, you know, exploding in our culture, which never really existed before. You know, we're seeing statistics. We're seeing these diseases that are so devastating to us now, but it's not like they were the primary diseases that were killing us 100 years ago. So we really need to take into account what's going on now in our society and our food and just our lifestyles in general, because it's all driving these chronic diseases. And I know that in your book you talked about like four of the factors that are key factors contributing to impaired brain function, optimal brain function. So maybe this is a good place to start talking about these causative factors that are affecting the brain, but I think we also have to say they impair overall optimal functioning of all the systems of our body as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. So our bodies were not designed to live to 80 to 90 years of age. So there are genes. Actually, I can start with talking about genes. So the question usually is this a genetic disease? And I say almost every disease is a genetic disease. Maybe not a car accident or a vehicle accident, but everything else is a genetic disease. We have genetic profiles. Some diseases like Huntington's, if there's one gene on chromosome 4. If that's affected, if the father has it, the son will get it at a certain time, and we know it. And that's driven by the gene solely and strongly. Other diseases, the chronic diseases of aging, are affected by genes, but it's not one gene. These are the genes of resilience, genes of response, meaning there are genes that have to do with vascular response, with immunity, with oxidative response. And either you have, you know, in the whole spectrum, semi-good genes or good genes or great genes as it pertains to those responses. So let's talk about Alzheimer's. And Alzheimer's, 5% of the genes, 5% of the patients who have Alzheimer's are heavily driven by a certain type of Alzheimer's genes, a presenilin-1, presenilin-2, and APP, meaning that if people have these genes, they're going to get it, and they're going to get it early. We can move it a little back and forth with a few years with the lifestyle, but they're going to get it within their life for majority. Actually, even for them, you can push it back quite a bit. But for the greater than 90%, that's where the 90% we talked about, the disease is a multi-genetic disease, meaning that so far they've identified nearly 30 genes, and they'll probably identify others as well. Now, what are these genes that are associated with Alzheimer's? Well, these genes are genes that have to do with your vascular response, meaning that if there's a little vascular trauma, how resilient is your vascular system? Your immune response, is it overreactive or underreactive? You know, your lysosomal storage, meaning the garbage disposal, how well does your cell get rid of the garbage that is produced over years, over 70, 80 years? So it's a response genetic profile. And that genetic profile doesn't mean you're going to get it at a certain age. It gives you a range, anywhere between 10 to 30 to 40 years. So if you've lived a certain type of life, let's say a lot of stress, a lot of oxidative, inflammatory, vascular, you know, bad glucose levels and bad lipid levels, then you're going to get it earlier in that gene range. If you've lived a good life, then you're going to get it much later in that risk, profile. So the genes gave you a range. What you did in life or what happened to you in life, like some things you didn't do, for example, head trauma, it was accidental. What happened to you in life will determine how early and late. And those processes, basically, we've named them into categorized into four. It could be any even less if we can reduce it. But basically, inflammation, oxidation, glucose dysregulation, and lipid dysregulation. And we can go into more detail. But those doesn't mean that you have them all at once. Some people come to this disease through a lot of inflammation. Let's say they have a lot of inflammation throughout their life. Even things like gum disease, chronic lifelong gum disease, Others have a lot of oxidation because of the foods and the kind of toxins in their body. Others, glucose dysregulation, a lot of high glycemic foods throughout life, which either cause diabetes type 2 or even before that. Now we know that insulin resistance, even just simple insulin resistance, although it's not simple, can put your risk, make you increase your risk significantly. We just are about to publish a paper on that. And lipid dysregulation, meaning that your cholesterol levels, your triglyceride levels are very high throughout life and it hasn't been managed, those can increase your risk. And they all interrelate as well, because glucose dysregulation goes into inflammation, lipid dysregulation goes into inflammation, and then finally they drive the final path, which is the amyloid, which is everybody has heard about amyloid and tau proteins and Alzheimer's and other diseases. But that, we believe, is later on, downstream. The other things that are related to lifestyle must be addressed. Sorry, I went along. But that's a very important concept that we wanted to bring about how lifestyle is affecting the brain. It's through these processes.
What do you think the role of our Wi-Fi world is playing in this? This is an area that I'm really concerned about and have been lecturing about and researching and writing about, is this impact from our ever-increasing EMF-penetrated reality. And I know there seems to be some studies now looking at the relationship of Alzheimer's or cognitive decline, cognitive impairment, and use of a lot of these Wi-Fi devices, or just being in a heavily Wi-Fi environment itself.
Yeah, we have been following the research, and we are trying to keep ourselves updated with all the latest data coming out. It is important to pay attention to it. You know, how could it not be important? It's something that all of us are exposed to on a regular basis, and I know that there's been some data about some brain cancers, you know, schwannomas and glioblastoma multiforme, and some of the other tumors that have been studied, and cell phone use particularly has been associated with the development of these cancers. But as far as cognition and memory and dementia is concerned, it's still under study. I know that there are a couple of groups who are interested in it, and they are looking into it, but we don't have any substantial data. I'm cautious, and I'm hopeful that we'll have some answers soon.
Right, I'm sure we will. And just because the research is coming out showing that exposure to the electromagnetic fields, microwave radiation, is increasing inflammation, oxidative stress, glucose dysregulation. So it seems to all be playing in, right? I do a lot of nutrigenomic testing, which is really a fascinating field right now of diagnosis, of looking at risk factors that you've inherited that can be altered through nutrition, lifestyle, everything you're talking about. And I have to say, looking at the panels that are evaluating the genes that the SNPs that regulate inflammation, oxidative stress, effective and efficient liver detoxification, which if it isn't done properly increases more oxidative stress. Majority of people did not, that I've seen, I've done hundreds of them now, really show a less capacity to manage inflammation, oxidative stress that exists in the world because of the genes they've inherited. So if they lived maybe 100, 200 years ago, they'd be able to thrive better in a non-toxic world, non-stressful world, or certainly not stress that we have today. But now they are not really well equipped genomically to thrive unless they make these lifestyle changes.
Yeah, that's very interesting that you said that. And, in population studies, we tend to see this as well. There's a particular lifestyle characteristics and a panel of things that people are very susceptible to compared to others. And, you know, it depends on your, now actually scientists are looking at zip codes and, you know, the restaurants around you, the level of noise and air pollution and all the other details that we never paid attention to, even street lights. All of these factors actually affect you. It would be interesting to do that level of research on Alzheimer's and dementia.
What you're speaking to, an integrative and a more comprehensive look at human beings. I mean, one of the things that when you come to Loma Linda, actually the central theme is, whole person, from the spiritual to the physical to the, you know, the mental, because it's the complexity that we have to get used to. And you're absolutely right. For more than 100 years, we've been looking at one molecule at a time, which is fine. It has served us well with the simple diseases like infections. Here's a bacteria. You kill it with an antibiotic. But when it comes to more complex the processes like the brain and the body in total, now we realize that you have to take much more into consideration, including, like you said, things that we don't understand yet, but we should study, like the microwave and the electromagnetic fields, as well as the environmental factors that we live in Southern California. We get a lot of smog here, and now we know that how it affects even your epigenetics. And we know epigenetics are more important than genetics themselves most of the time, and how the body's genes change depending on the environment they're in. And it's total, you know, complexity. So what's ironic is we're going back a little bit to the whole person aspect, but technology is helping us get a better handle of the complexity, and that's what's wonderful about it.
Yeah, so that's exciting, and I want to go in and explore some of the lifestyle and nutritional recommendations you have. But before I go there, there's one other area that I think is really important to talk about, and that is the impact from all the pharmaceutical drugs that people are taking, and what role do they play in impairing our cognitive functioning? Do you want to kind of explore that? I'll let you both take that one.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we have enough data that suggests that, you know, medications that are being taken by individuals chronically, they definitely affect our chemistry, our biology, and it affects the metabolism of food and the at the cellular structure, and definitely the brain, you know, the most active organ of the body with all the metabolism that is going on all the time. You know, take, for example, just, you know, simple over-the-counter antacid medication, you know, medicine that's been taken for heartburn and for GERD. Just, you know, a couple of years ago, there was a large sample data from a particular population that showed that people who take antacids and medication for heartburn tend to have higher risk of cognitive impairment. And it makes sense, because if you are constantly changing the environment of your stomach and your gastrointestinal system, it would definitely affect the absorption of different minerals and vitamins, and it completely changes the structure of the microbiota, the organisms that live in our gut. And then for the other category that has been studied very well are sleep medication, you know, benzodiazepines. We know that, you know, millions and millions of people are taking medication for sleep. You know, sleep disorders, chronic sleep disorders are an epidemic in this country. And even if they feel, you know, completely knocked out and they get, you know, 6 to 7 hours of sleep, we know that with those medication on board, people don't go through the stages of sleep that are responsible for memory consolidation, for getting rid of toxins from the brain. And those sleeping medication actually increase the risk of cognitive impairment. But on the same side, lack of sleep also affects the brain. So what we try to do is find out, you know, a middle ground of essentially treating it initially, but preventing chronic use of those medications that could potentially be very dangerous.
We have
to throw in statins too, don't we?
Yes. Absolutely. One study came out said that it actually affects the brain long term. And we know that short term, definitely there is short term memory deficits, but further studies have to be done. the point is, I think our relationship with medicine should change. As doctors, we're only trained to give pills or cut. I mean, I'm going to be a little blunt here, but, you know, these books that come out, including us being doctors, but we take pride in our public health background and our research background and preventive medicine background, but not so much MD, because when you go through medical school, let's take the 4 years of college, very highly driven, you know, biology, chemistry, nothing in nutrition and prevention. Then medical school, nothing as far as nutrition, prevention, lifestyle. Then 4 years of residency or 5 years of residency, nothing about nutrition, lifestyle, or any of that stuff. And then fellowship, nothing. And then you come out and you're in charge of people's lives. So there's a lot of pressure on you. So what you have to do is give what you've known. So to a hammer, everything is a nail. So everything is pills. We're not against pills. Pills have been great. Pharmaceuticals have been great for us. But the relationship has to become more complex and adjust to a more complex picture. Where there's need for pills, absolutely. But majority of the time, long-term care requires lifestyle change. Let's take blood pressure. Very important disorder. We just did a thing on the blood pressure. Yet blood pressure is deemed as if, I mean, if everybody suffers from blood pressure after a certain age, people think if they've taken the pill, they've done the job, not realizing that all it does is mask the disease, the underlying process. So you take care of you lower the blood pressure artificially, which is important because high blood pressure is a risk for stroke, for microvascular disease, even to Alzheimer's. But you haven't done anything to underline cause of the blood pressure, which is the vessels clogging, vessels stiffening, and all of those can be reversed over time, potentially through lifestyle. So we don't do anything to reverse. So in a year or two, now you need two blood pressure medicines. And then in another 2 years, you need three blood pressure medicines. And at some point, no amount of blood pressure medicine can take care of the problem because you didn't address the underlying process. So it's not about the fact that we're against medicine. We can't be. It's about our relationship has to be more understanding of the bigger picture, which is lifestyle should be included in this.
Kind of makes just common sense, doesn't it? You know, that we are making choices, some of which we have control over, some of which we don't, that are impacting how our brain is functioning.
It does. It does. It does make sense. And I think we're coming to a point where, you know, for a very long time, we were hyper-focused on one process, but we're stepping back to see the whole picture at this point. And we see that, you know, whatever advances we've made in science and technology, it's not innocuous all the time. It comes with its own risks. And it's best to live a life with prevention in mind rather than, you know, quick fixes and sick care and intervention.
So let's talk about what you would consider the top strategies, the most effective strategies, including nutrition and lifestyle factors that would support the optimal brain functioning and also support the brain being able to heal and function more efficiently.
I would start by saying the most effective thing is to know yourself. I mean, that's the most important aspect of everything. By that, what I mean by that is it depends on you. It's a personalized approach. If you have sleep apnea, and I can give them all the perfect diet in the planet, I will not address their brain problem because sleep apnea significantly increases your risk of dementia. So we haven't done so. If you have diabetes type 2 out of control, yet I tell them to go ahead and exercise, it might address that a little bit. But if we don't address the diet in that situation, we haven't done anything. And another person who has tremendous amount of stress in their life, they could be eating the best food in the planet and, you know, having great sleep, but the stress itself will have caused significant damage. So I would say the most important strategy is to figure out from our neuro plan what element actually is affecting your life the most. Start there and prioritize and slowly build towards, you know, a habit, a life full of habits that build the brain. So a personalized approach is critical. That's where I would start.
Well, I think that makes sense. You've kind of, each person has to evaluate what's going on in their lives and then prioritize what the most vulnerable area is and then begin to put strategies in place. So so after someone has done that, so we look at ways. I'm sure if a person is under a lot of stress, I certainly recommend meditation is one of the most important things a person can do to start reducing the harmful effects that stress creates in the body. What would be your recommendation?
I would agree with the meditation and stress management. Dean and I always say, you know, there is good stress and there's bad stress. And we wanted to identify good stress because sometimes there's a misunderstanding about stress, generally speaking. You know, keeping yourself challenged is always good, especially for the mind. We were talking about the synaptic connections and the resilience that you can build, and that challenge, especially when it's something that you enjoy doing and one has control over, is wonderful. But meditation, you know, and mindfulness in general, it doesn't just calm the mind. It doesn't just give you that opportunity to think better and to get rid of all the stresses, but it seeps into other fields of lifestyle as well. If one is mindful, if one knows, you know, all the different small elements in one's life and has control over it, that control seeps into nutrition, into exercise, into being socially active, sleeping well, all of it. So I think that's a wonderful place to start from, and making sure that, you know, keeping in mind that the benefits that one gets essentially help in organizing a better life.
That's exactly where we started. In fact, we do this a couple of times a day where we, even while we're driving, but usually I don't close my eyes during that time. But we.
Oh, well, but when those driverless cars come in, you'll be okay.
Yeah.
That actually increases my stress level when he does that.
No. No, but you're absolutely right. I think it starts with mindfulness, with meditation, with relaxation, whatever works for you. But it's the idea of taking control over the emotional aspects, which is what I was talking about earlier, wasn't I? Which,
yes.
If we can't take care of the emotional aspect, forget about taking care of the medical aspect. That's why we, as physicians, we fail so many patients because we don't take that into consideration. We just throw a bunch of medicines at them, and we haven't taken into consideration their mindfulness, their stress levels, and their ability to control all those factors. I would start every patient on that prescription first, which is meditation or mindfulness, a method of relaxing and controlling over their own mind.
And in very practical terms, that essentially means being organized. I think mindfulness and stress management for me means being organized. It means knowing everything around you and having control over it, being prepared, especially for self.
I think that's important, and it's also important to remind people, if they take 10 deep breaths, that begins a process of relaxation in the body. So we don't have to necessarily put 15 minutes, 20 minutes into our day. If you just start with 10 or 5 or just one deep breath, it begins a habit, right, that we can start expanding upon because we feel the benefits of it.
Exactly. We've actually done that in multiple talks. Dean and I go and we speak at, you know, different community centers. And there was this one instance we were at a community center and we asked everybody during a talk, there were about 500 individuals. We said, let's just all close our eyes and take a couple of deep breaths just for 30 seconds, nothing more. And for 30 seconds, there was perfect silence and you can hear everybody breathing. And it was one of the best experiences ever, and they actually wanted to continue doing it because it felt great. And like you said, just that simple action. You don't have to sit on a carpet, you don't have to fold your legs, you don't have to find a separate room. You can even do it in your car in the parking lot before you go to your office
without closing your eyes.
Without closing your eyes.
When you're parked, when you're not driving.
So when you're parked, exactly.
What are the worst foods that we need to be aware of that actually will contribute to killing our brain cells?
Anything that has processed sugar is just terrible for the brain. We've actually seen the instances where, you know, high glycemic load, when glucose enters your circulation right away and there's a spike in glucose, how that damages blood vessels, how that damages brain cells. It literally just fries your brain. So staying away from sugary foods, and, you know, these are the obvious sugars that we see on a regular basis, cookies, candies, cakes, and muffins, and, you know, things that are around us. Those are just terrible for the brain. And then in addition to that, anything that has saturated fats, you know, fats that are derived from, say, butter and meat and pork and ham and cheeses, all of those accumulate in the blood vessels and around the brain cells and cause the damage.
Well, how do you explain that to paleo people?
Well, you know, we've had some interesting conversations with the paleo people, and it almost becomes a cult-like conversation, unfortunately. But as far as, you know, just being a scientist, and to the best of our knowledge today, we have evidence that a paleo diet, or a diet that is almost, there's no carbohydrates in it and it's very high in fat, is not good for the brain, and it's definitely not good for the heart and the rest of the body either.
When I do my nutrigenomics, there's a panel that looks at the APOE gene, that risk factor, how well you manage toxins and fats. And what I learned is that there is about 15 or 20% of the population at the most that actually can manage a higher fat diet than the rest of the population. But actually, it's just a small percentage of the population. Most of the people have genes that require a lot less fats, and certainly not saturated fats. Actually, I think it's 10 to 15% actually that can manage a high fat diet. The rest of us, it creates more inflammation.
But let's take the paleo. I mean, we've done this many times. We've actually very systematically discussed with them that the science, the true science out there, the validated, repeatable science. If you were looking for anecdote, you can find anecdotes where people say, have written papers that if you eat a can of aluminum and it cures your cancer. That's not science. Science means that it has to be repeated by others that are not connected to you, and it has to be large enough, it has to be clear. Otherwise, anybody can say anything or anybody can produce any kind of paper. And it always comes back to appeal to authority or appeal to masses or appeal, you know, these fallacies. The paleo diet is wrong from anthropology side. The average paleo person didn't live past the age of 30. So why are we applying examples to people where we want to live past the age of 80? I mean, that's the whole point of these discussions. The average paleo diet person, they're talking about meat. I used to be a hunter. I would challenge anybody to try to catch a rabbit without a gun and then come back and tell me how successful you are at eating meat. I mean, it's wrong at the paleo side, at the anthropology side, at the anatomy side, at the biology side, at the biochemistry side. But the problem is that once it's confirmation bias, it's very difficult to change people's views when they're bought into a concept. Whereas we say we're not bought into any concept. That's why we said to the best of our knowledge today. The data that we presented in this book is more than 300 papers that are validated. And even there we say to the best of our knowledge today, the data after data shows that a whole food plant-based diet with a life full of activity, physical activity, stress management, and with cognitive activity, significantly lowers your chance of cognitive decline in Alzheimer's. So that's our approach to this. And the book is about empowerment, and the book comes out of our experiences in the communities that are outside of Loma Linda where we see devastation, I mean, stroke, vascular dementia, and Alzheimer's, and there's no genetic difference. It's environmental. And that's why 100% of the profits go back into those communities. So I love the fact that you're doing this and you're giving the kind of conversation that needs to be a little more complex, but the whole person in mind. So thank you for this.
Well, thank you, because your program is so helpful, so beneficial, it's so holistic, and I want to remind people that the book that Dean and Aisha Sharzai have written is called The Alzheimer's Solution, a breakthrough program to prevent and reverse the symptoms of cognitive decline at any age. Their website is Team Sharzai, and I'm going to spell Sharzai, which is sherzai.com. So it's teamsharzai.com. I recommend you go visit their website. You absolutely need to pick up a copy of The Alzheimer's Solution. The cover says something really important. It says, radically reduces the risk of Alzheimer's disease by 90%. That's such a radical statement and inspiring. Inspiring to know that we can reduce the risk of Alzheimer's, of getting Alzheimer's, by 90% by following the well-researched recommendations and information that Dean and Aisha Sharzai have written in their book, The Alzheimer's Solution. So I want to thank you for the great work you've done, the effort that it takes to write a book and get out there and communicate it. And it's inspiring what you are sharing with us and the hope that you're offering for everyone. So thank you both, Aisha and Dean Sharzai. It's been a pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you so much for having us, Cheryl, and thank you for everything that you're doing.
You're so welcome, and I want to thank all my listeners for, again, joining me with this fantastic conversation that happens every week on What Women Must Know. I hope you'll be returning next week for more fascinating and life-changing conversations. And until then, always remember to honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.